Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.
Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 15, Episode 15, The Lead Detective, in which Bob breaks down Lead Detective Dan McGinnis's trial testimony and more. We are sans Zach today, which you probably could figure out because it's my voice you're hearing. I'm Janet Barney, and I'm joined by Bob Ruff and lots of people in our chat and some listener questions.
Good job. Zach
could have
done it better himself.
Much.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thank you guys for joining us today. We've got a little bit of housekeeping that I can think of. We're kind of scrambling. We're used to Zach handling all our business and he's on assignment this week. One thing I do want to point out, by the time you hear this may be corrected, depends on how much time I have in the next couple of days, but shout out to listener Joni, who was going through the case documents and was reading through McGinnis's testimony. If you've been on the website to see, there's three versions of his testimony. So he testified, he was recalled, and then he was recalled again only for 5 pages during volume 5 of the transcripts. And she noticed that on those 5 pages, the transcripts start at line 4 instead of starting at line 1, which, you know, I didn't catch because most all but one of those pages, there's nothing really important missing there.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them was like you really wanted to know what was said next. So I went through the original scan and saw they were missing from the original scan. And then I went out in storage and dug out the hard copies because I'm the one that scanned them. I took them to our school and scanned them through our big giant scanner.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, it's not just McGinnis's testimony. That entire volume is screwed up.
Oh.
And it's weird because it cut off like an inch of it didn't scan like an inch of the top of the page.
Yeah.
Which I don't quite, because it's our scanner scans sideways.
Huh.
And it's in their front and back. All the pages, so yeah. It has to like bring them through and twist them around, whatever it does inside of that little machine. But somehow, it like on probably 3/4 of the pages in volume 5, it cut off the top of it. So I need to rescan volume 5 and then re-put that transcript up. So that is coming up. And the thing that's missing in there, we didn't really cover it this week's episode, was when McGinnis was recalled by the prosecutor at the end of trial. The purpose of that recall was him claiming that he did talk to Princella. So when Princella said that she called one thing I don't quite get the purpose of it, because if we heard Princella's, wait a minute, I'm, as just mentioned, because we have a trip coming up, I'm 3 episodes ahead right now that we've already recorded.
Okay.
And that's coming up later.
There is one tiny downside to being this on top of everything. Thank you, Erica.
Yeah, just recorded that episode yesterday.
Okay.
That I'm referencing. But so the other part that I was going to make a point about this episode was one of the things that I said that makes me absolutely crazy about this is that LaShawn says that police came in, talked to him right away, and he right away told them that day, no, Jody was at work. They couldn't have been there. As in the recall testimony, where the purpose of it is they're trying to refute something that Princella said, which you'll hear in a couple of weeks at trial. In that, he says, oh yeah, I went to the restaurant and talked to LaShawn Harper and Princella Tobias at the restaurant. So it was I think the part that nobody seemed to, of course, Jody's defense didn't pick anything like this out at trial. Then why isn't it in the police report?
Sure.
This is exactly like his testimony there proves exactly the thing that is pissing me off so much. He went and talked to Jody's employer. right then and there, on the stand, at trial, under oath, says, yes, I went there and I talked to LaShawn and Prinsella, but never documented. It's not in the report anywhere. You don't hear anything about that in the report. But that was the thing that was, so it was like the page ended that said, it was something along the lines of, so you talked to them, did you ask them if they had the, and then it cut off the next three lines, and the next three lines were something about, he didn't say time sheet, but I think he said the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it said, did they have the schedule? And it basically says, I don't recall if they ever gave it to me. Which is, you know, again, infuriating, because the schedule, the timesheet, he did have it, but at trial, he doesn't recall if he ever got it. But it was in the prosecutor's file the whole time.
Which, for some of the testimony, or the three testimonies, or however you want to say it, you do say in this episode, believe it or not, I feel like there's a lot of this seems credible, or at least that he makes a really good witness, and that the willingness to say I don't remember kind of stuck out as maybe like a good and honest thing to you, right?
Yeah, and some of the instances, you have to read it to see, when you read through so many transcripts, that you kind of get a feel for, you know, what the tone was kind of in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of the things, like, they'll ask him about something, he'll answer it, and they might ask like something that is really detailed that you wouldn't expect somebody to remember. And he says, like, I don't remember exactly that. I think I would have, you know, it's like, I think I would have talked to Officer McKee, but maybe it was somebody else. I don't, it was things like that. There was a lot of it throughout the testimony. The key, like the big things that I point out in this episode, and this part that we're talking about right now kind of goes right along with that, is when it comes to timing, right? When it comes to timing, that's when, like him saying that he got there before McKinney, and as far as, you know, nothing about the time of the crime, and then as far as like Jody's testimony, anything about timing, that's where, and part of it is, maybe it's because, you know, I know. So like when I read that part, maybe if I had not known that he did in fact have the timesheet the entire time, I might have read that and be like, oh, he just doesn't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that he did, like, he had it, sent it to the prosecutor. The prosecutor had it. None of them ever put it in. And then he says, and also there's something about that phrase, I don't recall, to me, that always seems disingenuous to me when I read. And if you read through his, the other times, he's not saying it. He's just like, oh, I don't remember exactly. He's speaking, you know, like a normal human.
I'm not sure, or
yeah. Remember. But it's always, I don't recall. It's like, it always feels like, not that it always is, but it always feels to me like a very intentional, like, I'm covering my ass here because I said I don't recall. So you can't say that I'm lying.
Right.
You know, something like that. In this case, like, I'm sure some people will say he really doesn't recall, but like I said, it's in the prosecutor's file. They had it. They didn't put it in as evidence. We don't know if they ever gave it to the defense. And then when it comes up, I don't recall. I don't buy it.
Right. Well, we actually have some feedback from Zach, even though we don't have him with us. He very kindly and thoughtfully sent me over some conversation points. You want to jump into those really quick?
Yeah.
And then we can talk about what the little that I kind of have before we get into our listener questions. So this is from Zach. Maybe I'm forgetting something, but after hearing this episode, I don't understand where Jody's name came from the night of the murder / early investigation. Leon Newcomb had been arrested for the robbery, but to my knowledge, the second suspect hadn't been identified yet. The officer's testimony about identifying Jody at the robbery was well after this, and now we know most likely fabricated. Ms. Lucas's statement about it was JoJo was also months later, and now known as untruthful. Where did Jody's name come from? How did they get on the radar so quickly?
So it's a really good question. And I had tracked some of this before. And I believe the first place where we hear Jody's name comes from Andre Williams. For a fact, we know that Andre Williams, in his like 5 a.m. interview, said that he had heard that Jody was responsible. So because I remember when I read it, I was shocked. I'm like, how are they saying that? Like, nothing's happened. How do they know this already? Like, why are they? And obviously, they don't know it. Jody was at work. But how did that name come up so quickly? And then in Sherelle's testimony, which we're going to get into a little while later, Jody's girlfriend, Sherelle, had stopped by the scene that night, as well as her friend, Nadia Butler. And they said that when they stopped at the scene at like 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, right after it happened, they said, Andre Williams told Sherelle, I think your boyfriend shot him. Like, so the earliest person that we have record of who immediately was saying that Jody did it was Andre Williams, as far as I know, which is interesting because, you know, there's all this weird stuff about Andre to begin with. They dropped him off at the crime scene right before Mario went there. And then later it was like, oh no, Mario was just looking for Andre. We have Victoria Miles saying that she thought he was outside talking to Andre right before the murder happened. She said she assumed it was Dre he was talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Andre Williams saying that, you know, that he was hanging out alone drinking with Mario all night on the other, you know, up by the Miles house when Candace Smith says they were either driving around with him or they were looking for him the whole time when she was with Mario. So there's all this weird. So there's like this weird stuff all around Andre Williams. And then Andre Williams is immediately pointing the finger at Jody.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Zach also says the testimony about the lighting conditions is extremely telling. The idea that they had to use their headlights to light the scene and that the side of the house was really dark. The only light on the entire scene was the inside entryway light.
Yeah. And that's like, and I'm telling you, there was no light on that other house. I cannot 110% verify that there was never a light there. But for most of you guys know this, like before and during my time as a fireman, I was a contractor. I know what to look for if there was, you know, if there used to be a fixture somewhere, especially a house that's not well taken care of like that one. Like, there will be conduit there. There will be an electrical box there. There will be wires there. There will be a pole. There'll be something there. There is nothing on the side of that house. And then, we hear McGinnis saying it was completely dark over there. And somehow, like, we're still not calling into question Victoria saying she looked out in that completely area that was so dark they had to use their car headlights to see anything. And she's describing the tall, skinny guy with the ponytail running away.
Right.
In a situation where the timing doesn't make sense either.
Right. And then finally, Zach says the idea that Jody got combative on the way to take a polygraph for the murder, and that's when McGinnis decides to charge Jody for the robbery, doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah, me neither. And I think the emphasis there is that was the reason they decided to charge him with the robbery.
Right.
What I remember when I very first got the file, reading McGinnis's report about Jody's interview, and I remember reading how Jody or McGinnis was emphasizing that Jody started off like very cordial. He was cooperative. And then as they pressured him and basically started accusing him, Jody started to get real mad. And the way McGinnis wrote it was like almost like that made him look guilty.
Right.
Or made them look guilty because Jody was like getting mad during that. And I just remember the first thing I was thinking about was back when I first started to learn how to do statement analysis from Jim Clementi.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, and I think it was on one of the episodes of the podcast. I don't remember which case we were talking about, but he was talking about, it might've been the one where we interviewed, might've been Jamie Snow, or it might've been something to do with Jesse Eldridge's interview somewhere along there.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember him saying, innocent people get real mad when you start accusing them. Like that's always stuck in my mind. It was like if somebody's guilty, they're really conscious. And this is all obviously typically, right? Not always.
Yeah.
But typically, a guilty person doesn't want to let the tiger out of the cage, so to speak, right? Like they don't want you to see that they're angry. So they'll keep like, no, I just don't do it. He says, we're an innocent person generally tends to get very angry when you keep accusing them of something they didn't do.
Right.
And I just remember that like popping into my mind when I was reading through that, because it was like the way McGinnis wrote it was like, and then he got really angry. And I remember thinking, well, I remember Jim telling me that that's a sign that they're probably innocent, that
right.
they're getting mad. And then Jody insisting on the polygraph. And then I need to talk to Jody about like what went on in the car, because I'm so distrusting of McGinnis.
Right.
You know, because like when I first read this report, I've always taken it as fact that, oh, so, you know, Jody got pissed off in the car and mm-hmm. so they didn't take him to do the polygraph. But now after everything else you've learned, I'm like, well,
was that even true?
But did they?
Yeah.
Or did McGinnis just not take him? Or right. what are they calling combative? I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is weird how it's like, okay, we'll take you to get a polygraph. Oh, they're being combative, so we're going to charge them with robbery. I agree with Zach. That's odd.
Yeah. It's like A to D, where you're like, wait, there's some steps I like not understanding that you're making it seem like, well, of course I would do this because this happened, but meanwhile other people are going, wait, why? Why does that equal that?
I want a quick answer. Tool Girl in the chat wanted to know if Jody and Andre had any issues between them, and did they know each other? As far as I know, they didn't know each other. Like, I feel like in one of Andre's reports, they, you know, they had heard from somebody or heard from somebody that it was, I think the quote was the a light-skinned guy from out in the Heights or something like that. Hmm. Like, I don't think they knew each other. No.
Yeah.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
In Zach talking about what the scene looked like and the clarification on some of that, and again, you know, these kind of changing, shifting stories from person to person about what it looked like, what it didn't look like, whether there was music, whether there wasn't music, whether the trunk, you know, why the trunk would have been propped open, the piece of wood propping the hatchback open. So maybe we've talked about this before, but presumably the hatchback maybe didn't, something was up with the hinge and like it was sort of...
Yeah,
didn't stay up by itself, so you'd need to prop it up with...
Yeah, I'm guessing the shock that, you know, there's like a little shock on your hatchback so we keep them up, yeah, didn't work. Because I'm assuming if that was the case, Mario probably had like a stick there or something, like, mm-hmm, a piece of wood in there that he would use to keep it propped open.
Yeah.
But the big thing to me, what I've thought from the very beginning of this, ever since I read Canvas Smith's original report, where she said that when Mario dropped her off, he said he had something to do, but he would be back. And then he went to that scene. My immediate thought was, you know, Mario didn't just get jumped there. He wasn't there by happenstance. He went there to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start hearing about that the hatchback is open. And it was, again, always presented like, and the prosecutor, even at one point in some of these testimonies, like, oh, because he had these great speakers back there and that's why the thing was open. But like, he may have had great speakers back there, but he clearly wasn't blasting the speakers. Like, that's not what was, he didn't have the trunk open so that he could blast the music really loud. Dewan James didn't hear it across the street. And then the officers coming in, like Takamoto doesn't recall if there was any, doesn't remember hearing any music. Deenick says he thinks there was. And then when I touched on in the episode where I said, I know it would be memorable if it was loud.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because that's from my own personal experience.
Yeah.
That is fucking nerve wracking.
Oh God, of course.
In an emergency situation. Because I can think of one incident specifically, and it wasn't music, but it was a horn. And there's another one I think of with music, but the horn was the bad one where I pulled up this bad car accident.
Oh, sure.
And it ended up being fatal.
Yes.
And I'm trying to like check out the body, do all this work, and this goddamn horn was just blowing, and it was like,
oh, that's,
I
don't,
it was like somebody stabbing me through the,
oh,
through the ears.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because it was so loud, it was just nerve-wracking. And I remember, like, I grabbed a tool out of my bunker gear and just cut the battery on the car.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, I can't take it. I can't stand it. And everybody on the scene was the same way.
Right.
And so, like, if music was, like, blasting out of the car, they would have shut it off immediately. They're not going to leave that blasting going because it's nerve-wracking as hell for the first responders when you're trying to think.
Of course. So what would make sense would be the person who really was there on the scene first, if it's Takamoto, he would be the one that it would make the most sense, truthfully, if one person said there was music. It's most likely that it would be like the first officer to the scene would be like, well, first thing I'm going to do, put on some gloves, turn that off. Like, you know what I mean?
This is what I think happened. When I said I think there probably was music, but it was probably quiet.
Mm-hmm.
So Deenick and Takamoto get to the scene together, mm-hmm, same car. They were riding together. Takamoto went straight to the body. Deenick went around the side of the house where the car was, looking, mm-hmm, to make sure there's nobody else there.
Mm-hmm.
Takamoto doesn't recall there being any music.
Mm-hmm.
Dienick says he thinks there might have there was music.
Okay.
That's why I think there probably was music playing, but it was probably turned way down.
Right.
Dienick was walking over by the car, whereas Takamoto was going straight to the front door. So I think Takamoto couldn't hear the music from where he was at, but Dienick was over by the car and he could hear it from over there.
I got it.
Kind of tracks too with Duan.
Right.
Being across the street and not hearing it over there.
Right.
You know, so that's why I think there probably was. I don't think they're lying about there being music, but I don't think that the purpose of the trunk being open was so because they were blasting music. I think there was probably something in the trunk that had to do with that meeting. That's my theory, but that tracks with the things we know about Mario. We know that Mario was, from what other witnesses have said, was selling marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
We know that he told, at least from Canvas's first story, that he dropped her off because he had something to do, and he's just sitting in this parking lot there.
Mm-hmm.
Like what? Even if it was in her second version, which was she left, or at her trial version, that he dropped her off to go look for Andre.
Right.
In either case, like if he's looking for Andre, why does he just go to the place where they already know Andre isn't?
Right.
And just sit there, stand there. You know, it doesn't make sense. It's like I think that he was meeting somebody there. I think there's a possibility that what he's doing was making a deal there that somebody came up. The states, what they push, their narrative that they're pushing is that the trunk was open because he had these great speakers and he was blasting his stereo. And that, in my opinion, clearly was not the case.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the only reason I come back to it is that it just feels like a lot of work to do, almost proving your point or proving that, you know, what you suspect may be true. It just seems like a lot of work to do if nothing about the trunk matters. It just seems like, why are you going to so much trouble? Like, whether there was something in the trunk or not, he could have had music playing softly. He could have had it played loud. It wouldn't necessarily have to matter, except that somehow it's very, very important that the only reason that the trunk was open was that he was like chilling and blasting music. And so it draws a circle around it. Like, it draws more attention to it. To me, and of course, this is hindsight, like we have information available showing us all the discrepancies. So that's what makes it draw a circle around it. But it's just to look at that and examine it. It's like, God, I wouldn't have cared that much had you not made a huge thing about how loud the music was and that was the whole point. Now I suspect that maybe that's not true, you know?
Yeah.
Like and selling also, it like, too hard.
I mean, the whole story, you have to think about it like this. In an episode coming in a couple of weeks, I really kind of got on to some folks about cognitive, not anybody in particular, but just in general, this kind of cognitive dissonance. How just like, I believe Jody's guilty. I have to believe Jody's guilty. So I have to believe this narrative. But you have to think about this logically. So whichever version you believe, if you believe that Mario is out partying with the Miles's and all those people out there, why would he leave and just go hang out in a parking lot by himself at his friend's house? He could have went inside to Victoria's.
Right.
But he's just hanging out outside by himself. Or if you believe Canvas Smith, he's hanging out with her. He seems to be a very social guy. Why would he drop her off because he needs to go stand in a parking lot and listen to music by himself for a while?
Right.
And tell her that he's coming back to get her.
Right.
Or if he's going to look for Andre, why does he just go sit in a parking lot by himself and listen? Like that scenario of whatever version of which, whoever story you want to listen to, of Mario just all of a sudden decides to go stand in a parking lot by himself and quietly listen to music.
Yeah.
Doesn't, like, that scenario is nonsense. There's no way. But that scenario has to be it, because it has to be that Jody was looking for him and Jody is talking and Jody just happened to catch him there alone. And was planning to go kill him the whole time. It can't be what is, I think, if you really seriously just take a step back, the most logical answer is that he was meeting someone there.
Yeah.
That's not a crazy conspiracy theory. That's not a huge leap. That's what logic tells you was happening there, was that he was meeting somebody there. And we have witnesses, at least one witness, who says they saw him there with a bunch of people.
Right.
Like there were people there. Like that's just what makes the most sense. The idea of him just going there just to hang out. You have to know that's nonsense.
Right. Right. Okay, I want to get into some of these questions from our wonderful listeners. First of all, keeping it simple, Tool Girl just wondering, you mentioned in the episode up top that there may be other records, other versions of the records out there because of the state police. Any updates on that? Anything you can add to that?
Slight update. Yeah, so I was talking to one of the troopers that worked the case and that I know, and he said, well, you know, if you can get my report, I can read it and I'll have better memory of it. And I told him, I was like, I sent the murder book and I'm like, this is all there is. And he's like, that's all, we should have more than that. And that, and I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, the state police task force, or the task force was activated, the homicide task force, state police is part of that. He said, procedure was that all agencies connected to the task force all got copies of all the files.
Hmm.
And I said, so, well, are you saying the state police would have the full file and still have it? And he said, they absolutely should. So that's when I fired off the FOIA request to the state police. I just got a response yesterday, and the response was, we need 10 more days, which is, sounds crazy, but that's typical in Michigan. And in Michigan, everywhere, and with my students, they're all doing Michigan cases that they're working on for my investigative journalism class. So they've all had to file, I think we filed like 15 FOIAs in the last few weeks, the students have.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them all, this is what happens in Michigan. Michigan law says they have 5 days to respond. Michigan law also says that they can automatically be given a 10 business day extension if they ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's automatic. I said, so on day five, you will generally get, we're taking 10 more days.
Yeah.
And it's happened with every single one of their cases. And that's what I got today, or yesterday, I think it was. I got the response saying we're taking 10 more days to get the files. But the good news is, what they didn't say is, we don't have that file.
Right. And just to be clear, you're not saying that there's something nefarious about that. Many institutions, like bureaucracies, just are always chasing the thing that they have to deal with right in front of them. And it's just like, kick this down the road. Or do you feel like that's a thing that's like, no, we know we could give it to you today, but we're going to make sure we don't do that.
No, I don't think it's anything. That was my point, is it's not anything. It's like we have filed requests from all these different municipalities, and
yeah,
they all do the,
you just have to kick
thing
it down the road because you got your, yeah, big stack just, in front of you.
It and, takes time. We're talking about a case from 23 years ago. I fully expect that we'll get the full. And so my hope is that when we get that, number one, we'll get crime scene photos, which would be huge. And also, if there was any recordings, I really suspect. And by the way, on that topic, I had name dropped Wendell, one of our great listeners, who does a really good job of like analyzing writing and statements and stuff like that,
mm-hmm,
about the recording. And seemed like he didn't necessarily think that it was that they had the recording, but definitely that they had gone over like exactly what was going to be asked, because that's kind of lock and step with the report, everything. The one that got me is, I didn't see in the report anywhere where McGinnis says that he asked multiple times about Jody having a weapon.
Hmm.
So that was the thing. And it could just be that was a conversation they had. I don't know. I've always found it odd that they didn't record the interview. And then I think one of the listeners had pointed out, like, what would be the point of, if they recorded it, of saying that Jody said they got off work at 10 o'clock? And the point that, to answer that, the point is, if what Jody said was, I didn't even get off work till midnight and got home at 1 a.m. on the recording, that's a giant problem.
Right.
So you lose the recording. And I'm not saying this happened, but I mean, yeah, this would be the utility of it. So then you say you didn't record it, and then you can just write whatever you want. And you can just write that. And think about, like, just think of a world. Again, I'm not saying this is what happened. I am saying McGinnis lied. That's my opinion very strongly. I don't think there's a chance in hell Jody said they got off work at 10. That's ridiculous.
Right.
And you'll hear, again, in an upcoming episode, you'll just hear just how ridiculous that is. But I, as far as like recording it and getting rid of the recording, but think about, by not having that recording, if you just consider for a moment that McGinnis is like lying about all this stuff that Jody said in there, the position it puts a defendant in, you have an officer, a uniformed officer on the stand that says, and they can make up whatever crazy, mm-hmm, insanity they want to say.
Yeah.
That, yeah, they told me they got off at 10. The position that puts the defendant in, even when they take the stand then later and say, no, that's not what I said. Most 99.9% of jurors are going to believe the officer.
Right.
They're not going to believe the person that was arrested for it, who's just claiming the officer lied about something they said. It's like, it's a pretty brilliant tactic on the cop's part. If you're trying to be a corrupt cop and you want to just write your own story, don't record anything. And just write, I mean, because there's multiple, as we go through these next couple of weeks, there's multiple witnesses that get on the stand and they're questioned, didn't you tell the police this? And they're like, I didn't say that. No, I never said that.
Yeah.
Several witnesses that that happens with. So it really puts them in a really bad position.
Yeah.
And one of the things I'm hoping is I'm actually thinking I'm also going to file a FOIA request with the Niles City Police Department, because I believe it was a Niles City officer that was in the room with McGinnis during that interview. And I'm wondering if it would be great if by chance they also kept their file, and if they kept any handwritten notes
from sure.
If there's no recording, it would be interesting to see with those handwritten notes, because again, the paradigm or the paradox between the same people that think, oh, Jody probably did say that got off at 10, are the same people saying Jody faked the timesheet and wrote 1205.
Yeah, those two things don't work.
Yeah, like you go through all that trouble to plan out, I know I need more time, so I'm right. going to write in this timesheet that I didn't get off work at 1205, and then 18 hours later, I do an interview and say I got off at 10.
Right.
Like those don't compute.
Yeah,
they don't add up. And that's why I say I'm fully convinced that McGinnis is just straight up lying about that.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. I mean, I can totally accept believing one or the other, but I don't. And if you think that Jody is guilty, like I can see believing one or the other, but I don't understand how you can believe both. But I'm sure there's a way.
Five new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Question about the task force, and I apologize if you explained this in the episode and I'm just blanking. Why was there a homicide task force that included other law enforcement agencies? Is it because the crime was so rampant? Was it because of activity that was being like, maybe we need somebody watching what's happening? Like, do you know anything about that?
I don't know why. I mean, the only place where there were consistently murders in this whole county was Benton Harbor, so I assume that has partly something to do with it. But it was a countywide homicide task force, so I don't know if it was specifically because of crime in Benton Harbor, or if it was specifically because they felt there needed to be some oversight in Benton Harbor. I mean, there have been plenty of situations where the state and other people have come in and said there needs to be oversight in Benton Harbor. As a matter of fact, I can't get into the details because the person was off the record, but I had somebody who works for a state agency write in this week and tell me some interesting things about how certain people in that municipality felt about any kind of federal or state oversight of their police department.
Well, sure. But, you know, you could see someone not wanting that, whether they were an honest cop or a dishonest cop, I guess.
Yeah.
If you think that, you know, other municipalities should stay out of your business.
Yeah, it was something to do with there was, I mean, I have the specifics, but there was I just need to verify them independently so that this person isn't connected to them. But essentially, there was a federal program that was supposed to come in and to do something innocuous, not to investigate Benton Harbor City Police Department,
mm-hmm.
but they were coming into many communities to help institute this program, and they were pushed out of Benton Harbor because they didn't want federal law enforcement anywhere near them. even though it was just, you know, it was like a community outreach thing is what they were doing.
Gotcha. Okay, let's move on to Teresa S., who says, I have a question. Is there any significance to the difference between Jody's report that during the robbery, they accidentally shot into the roof inside the car versus the police report that Mario was shot in the hand during the attempted robbery? I might not have hit all the details 100%, but that's the general idea.
So there's a little confusion about it, but there's not a conflict there. I don't think Mario was actually shot in the hand. I believe, based on all the different accounts of it, that he was either like just grazed by the bullet or that the mechanism of the gun like pinched his hand. Like he had just like he basically had a scratch on his hand. So I don't know if it was like the hammer of the gun or something like pinched and cut his hand, or the bullet grazed his hand or something like that. But in both cases, it was like gun goes off during a struggle and somehow Mario's hand got cut.
And for those of us who, this is so not important, but for those of us who don't have a lot of experiences just with guns in day-to-day life in different situations when you're not on a firing range wearing like headphones and stuff, like just how loud is a gun going off, even if you have one door open? Like how much sound would that have made? Like, would you be kind of temporarily deafened? Like what is...
Not from that gun. That was a 22.
Oh, the 22
revolver.
Is pretty quiet, yeah.
Yeah, a 22 is an itty bitty tiny little round. So it gotcha. Doesn't sound much louder than a cap gun.
Gotcha.
Inside the car, it would be louder, but it's not... Now, if you fired the 45 like Mario was shot with inside there, it would, your ears would be ringing for hours after that.
Yeah.
But with the 22, no.
Got it. Okay. Jill says, are we... Well, Jill, I'm going to put your qualifier in here, even though I don't think you need it. Jill says, this may be a dumb question, but are we supposed to infer something about them having to go wake up the lead detective? Is this common? I would have thought whoever was on shift would get the case, or is it an indication he was messing up, at least by not answering the phone? I get that going to wake him up affects the timeline, and I assume that's why we're mentioning it so often, but it gives the impression that he started out messing up on the case by not answering his phone. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to get that impression or not.
No, I don't think so. I mean, that stuff happens. So it's similar to, so I was an arson investigator. I had my shift that I worked in, but if I was off duty at home, then, and they needed an arson investigation, they might call me to come in to help with the investigation. And there have been times, not with me, but like other investigators that, you know, they just, you're sleeping. It just happens. Sometimes you just don't hear the phone ringing.
Yeah.
Don't hear the radio, whatever. So no, there's nothing to infer there. It's just what happened.
Gotcha.
Is they called him and he didn't answer. And then he didn't live far away from there. So they ended up just walking over to his house and getting him. Also, I want to point out Josh in the chat, who is a professional shooter, pointed out that as far as the loudness of the gun that you were asking, Janet, he's put the shorter the barrel, the louder the report. So because it's a pistol as opposed to a rifle, it's going to be louder because the barrel is shorter.
Gotcha.
But it's still not super booming, ear-ringing loud.
Gotcha. Thanks, Josh. And thanks, Jill. Listen, you don't know how many other people listened to the episode and wondered if they were supposed to infer the same thing, so I'm glad you asked it.
Yeah, and Tool Girl also in the chat pointed out, too. Remember, it's a small department. So, like, in New York City, there are cops that are on duty on the night shift. There's cops that work 24 hours a day. In a place like Benton Harbor, you know, usually, like, one of the advantages of getting promoted to detective is you work, you know, 8 to 5 or whatever, and then you go home. The downside is you're always on call and you have to come back in. So there were no detectives, I don't think, that were on duty at night. It's just patrol officers.
Gotcha. And how many detectives ended up at the scene altogether? Just two?
Just two, yeah. Okay.
Solomon says, I feel that it's a numbers game for the police forces. Every time someone is killed, that's at least two off the street. The victim and the real or fabricated killer. Doesn't matter to them who's who. Over time, it gets out of control and cops lose themselves and their purpose, serve and protect, in all the chaos.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. And that's, I pitch this book all the time, but that book, Ghetto Side, gets into that a lot about how, you know, how officers that are working in these inner cities over time get to a point where they kind of lose their, they don't view their humanity changes.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're looking at like all of these people, they look at the entire community as all of these people are a problem for me. So if somebody gets killed, that's one less on the street. And then if we put somebody in prison for it, that's one less on the street as well. And I think you get to a point where it just seems like in this one, again, I keep coming back to it, but going to the restaurant that morning and finding out that there's no way Jody could have done this, and then still pursuing him and then never documenting any of that. It tells me like they don't. I don't know. Like I said, Jody thinks that this was intentional as far as them being kind of being framed for this. I think that that might have played into it. I think that McGinnis might have had some kind of issue with Jody and so was happy to put Jody in prison. But also, I really think the more and more I read the the question earlier about when did Jody's name come up? It came up with Andre Williams, like a meet that night.
Yeah.
I think probably it's more to do with, oh, we got another murder to solve. And then a bunch of these people at the scene who happen to be Andre and all the Miles's that are there saying, well, that guy did it.
Right.
Then they're like, okay, that guy did it. And they just make their mind up. And again, like I've said many times in this season, there was no checks and balances at that time. Nobody gave a shit. You know, they arrest somebody who is, you know, doesn't have the financial or family or anybody means to help them or to shine a light on their case. And they just go through the courts, they go to prison and they're forgotten about.
Yeah. Tony says, even though Jody is innocent, do you think it's possible they lied to investigators about things like handling firearms because they were scared and didn't want to look guilty?
Oh, absolutely. And we've talked about that before. Even when we were talking about the robbery before, it's not, I know there are still some people that, you know, can't get past that. And that's their own viewpoint on it. You know, we know kind of the circumstances that all the folks in that town were kind of living in, and the kind of way of life there is not a way of life that I'm familiar with or comfortable with. But the bottom line is, if as far, you know, getting mad at Jody because Jody held a gun to somebody is, I think, reasonable. Getting mad at Jody because Jody lied about that, I don't, like, obviously, like, surely no one expects that they would go in and be like, yep, I did the robbery. But I didn't do the murder.
Right.
They're not going to, no one's going to do that. Not a human being in the world is going, I mean, like people don't just generally just confess to that. Most people are going to try to lie and get out of something.
Especially if you feel like there's no rules. And like, if the people that are supposed to be playing by the rules are not playing by the rules, then the idea that you would be like, I'm going to rise above all of this, no matter what happens to me, I'll be the only one telling the truth in this scenario. I'm just laughing because I'm laughing because it's such a depressing thought to be even in that position, but I don't know who would do that.
But the point is well received, and that is why I think if people are really, really listening and really paying attention, like there's a reason the first episode of the season was what it was. Like, if you're really letting yourself understand that the way of life for the community of the people that live in Benton Harbor is different probably than the life that you're living. There's background in how they got there. And then also the episode about all the corruption with, you know, I was sick that one, so it was really, you know, shorter than I would have liked it to have been. But to understand that, like you said, like everybody's lying, like they're reading in the newspaper, you know, a couple times a week about how these cops are lying and beating their wives and getting DUIs and doing all this stuff and getting away with it. That does, whether you think that it wouldn't for you, I can promise you it does make a difference for the people that live there, where they're like, why am I going to come in and just be, like you said, like rise above all this and be the honest one? They see the cops that, you know, one of the first people that I talked to when we got out and started talking to people on the streets of Benton Harbor, as soon as I told them what we were doing, their exact quote to me was, fuck the police. Yeah. You know, which I know is, you know, that's a reference to a song, but like, that's the mentality is like, they said they're all crooked. Yeah. They all harass us. And that's what I heard over and over and over again. That's how they all viewed the police. They're not there. You've heard Angelique very eloquently explain that. Like, they are not there to serve and protect the way the community feels about them. Right. Even the people that aren't mixed up in all the violence that's happening, they're not there to serve and protect us. They're there for the way they see it, their own purposes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Brandon says, does Andrew Collins have any knowledge about this case?
I don't think so. Brandon Collins became a cop in Benton Harbor in 2003. So was that
Andrew. Sorry, you just said Brandon.
Andrew
but that,
Collins.
But you know what? That's an apt segue because here you are with a perfect example of someone who was on the inside of that, who was like, you know, did not, was careful, if memory serves, to not throw a bunch of, you know, fellow law enforcement at the time under the bus, but certainly was like, yeah, I mean, this is a culture I was taught. This is a culture I came up in. And this is the way that it spun out of control for me. So his version of that about making money or making money for the department or, you know, making himself look better for the same kinds of glory that, you know, other people do other bad things ties into what Solomon was saying, too. It's not just about homicide. It can be about robbery or drugs or reselling drugs or look at all those things, like you said, that came out that are just out there about all kinds of police officers, not just the ones that we're talking about in this one in Benton Harbor.
Yeah. And also, like, keep in mind, that's like Andrew Collins' story is relevant, too, because when he's describing that culture that the Benton Harbor Police Department was that he was working in. Yes, he got on the department after Jody was convicted, but it was right after Jody was convicted.
Yeah.
All these same officers were still there.
Yeah.
He worked all these names that we've heard throughout this season are the same people that Andrew Collins was working with during all of that. Like, right. And we just, you know, we were chatting offline before we got on how just in this last week, both Zach and I talked to law enforcement officers who gave us we're not giving any details about either one, but painted a pretty grim picture of particular people, particular names in this case, and the culture in Benton Harbor and those cops. One of the ones I spoke to was working as a Benton Harbor cop at the time. Doesn't remember this particular case. He was just a patrolman, but you know, when I started talking to him about the case, he's like, yeah,
sounds
probably.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Final thing is from Nancy. This may be a comment more than a question, but I wanted people to know that one of the ways things get as bad as they do in Benton Harbor is that it's very difficult to campaign for office as someone who is actively opposed by the police. It makes it much harder to have events where you need a permit. Your yard signs may disappear. Your staff might get harassed. There's a documentary about Cory Booker's run for mayor of Newark. The police supported the incumbent and made his race a lot harder. In theory, a democracy, people could use the political process to rein in police misconduct, but it's hard to get politicians to actually do it. That's another little piece of the puzzle that we're talking about here, right? It's hard to take over and be in a position of power if the people currently in power are very much against you exposing anything that they're doing. Like, wow, that would be so hard.
Well, and I've talked to people in the community who about running for office. You know, I've had a lot of those conversations where it's like, what do we do? Like, I can't fix this from here. Like, you all have to fix it from within the community, and we're here to help. But like, you need people to step up and run for mayor and run for office and get in there. And I think there's some people that are probably going to do that the next go around. But at the same time, the other thing I hear is a lot of them are scared.
They're sure.
Like, they've told me, like, you don't understand the way they see it. You don't understand how corrupt this police department is. Like, this is like shit from the movies. Like, if they're going to run for mayor on a platform of I'm going to, you know, get rid of the police chief, they feel like they will be arrested. They will be harassed. They will, you know, violence will come on them. Like, you know, from the stories that they tell. And again, I have no way of verifying what's true and what's not. But from the stories they tell, that, you know, some of the officers are connected with some of the people that are committing the violence and the drug dealing and the things that are happening, that they're kind of part of that. And they're like, it's a scary thing to stand up and say, I'm going to make a change here. And then you got to fight. You know, if they're right and the police department is corrupt as they feel it is, it's a terrifying, terrifying situation.
Well, it also makes sense that if this is the culture and that this is the culture you've created, that someone from that environment, the person who would be potentially attracted to joining that police force would be a person who has some understanding and that would stick it out, would be someone who had some understanding of what the benefit would be to being a part of the police force, having connections to the crime in the community. Like, I don't think that if that's known in your neighborhood about the police, who is that attracting to come and reform themselves? Like, what young kid is going to be like, you know what? I'd like to join the police force. I bet I could make a change in this neighborhood. Like, if it were me, I would be a person who's like, what do I stand to gain from joining the police force the way it is now? Because I ain't going to be able to change it. Well, maybe I could get on the inside of some deals or whatever. Like, the whole thing is so cynical, but it's cynical for a reason. It's cynical economically. It's cynical emotionally. It's cynical politically. It's just broken. And so changing it is very hard.
Yeah. And I think what you see a lot of is a couple different versions of a story. One is Andrew Collins' version, where you go in with the best intentions. Because again, the other side of that is, you know, it's hard to get a job as a cop. I'm probably getting easier and easier now, but it's always been, you know, historically, there's a lot of, you know, there's 100 people applying for every job that comes up. And so they'll take what they can get. And because most people don't want to go work in Benton Harbor, they end up in Benton Harbor. And so I think, you know, Andrew Collins' version of the story is one where you go in with the best intentions and you get sucked into the machine, or it becomes a stepping stone where you go there, you're like, fuck this, and you keep applying until you, now you got a little bit of experience and you get the hell out of there. That happens a lot too. There's a, I know a ton of officers in this county that I've worked with over the years that got their start in Benton Harbor, did 6 months, a year, and as soon as they could get out of there, they got out of there.
Mm.
And some of those are the same officers that are coming forward, you know, and talking to me now and telling me, yeah, some of that, like, that shit was going on. Like, the shit, you know, changing the times and framing people and pressuring witnesses and threatening them and get like I've had officers that were working for Benton Harbor at this time that said that, yeah, that's what they did. Of course, that's what they did. That's what was going on all the time. Like this, like the things I'm saying to you, for the people that are acting like this is crazy conspiracy theory, I'm telling you it's not. I can't, I'm not telling you 100% that's what happened, but when I'm picking through the evidence and that's the picture that I'm getting, and then cops that worked for that city, for that department at that time are telling me I'm certain that's what happened. When they worked on the inside, like, I'm not out of line. These are not conspiracy theories. This is what was happening at that time. And with that being said, you said that was the last question.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go ahead and wrap this things up. Look at us, just me and you, no Zach, and we still got 50 minutes out of this thing.
That's right. Well, we still had Zach because we talked a lot about his feedback too. So
yeah.
Thanks, Zach.
So this week you got to hear all about McGinnis's version of events as far as the investigation. Some of that was pretty useful. We got some new information. But we also heard a lot about what McGinnis says went on with Jody in their interview. And this week we get the other side of that. We're going to get Jody Hill's testimony, where we'll hear what they had to say, their version of what happened, both at the through their interview. And also a big one was Jody is taking swings like crazy. When you read this testimony, and I read a lot of it to you in the episode, you could tell that Jody is, their defense attorney wasn't doing shit. They got on the stand and they are just, I've never read a transcript like this before, where they're just throwing evidence out, they're pointing things, and it's crazy that it's being allowed. Like, Jody's narrating from the stand, Jody's asking the prosecutor questions.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really something. So that's coming up this Sunday. Tune into that, make sure you give it a listen, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, everybody. Bye, guys.
Bye, guys. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.